Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And talk about world travelers.
No kidding. Today is the show of world travel, for sure.
We're about 8,000 to 10,000 miles from each other in this one.
Yeah, except that you actually got to go somewhere and I didn't. Wait a minute, there's something not quite right about this.
Your time's coming, kid, believe me.
I did mine via the telly.
Another great stop in Hawaii, and they're all great, really, is a place called the Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden. It's in Kona, about south of Kona, a few miles, but I met a woman named Bernice Akamini, and she's a native. It's a 15-acre reserve where they're doing two things that are really neat. One, they're trying to restore a lot of the plants that were there when the Polynesians settled the islands thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. And two, they're showing people how these plants were used.
Okay,
so not only do you have these ancient plants, but they're
Thus the ethno part of the botany, like putting them into some sort of cultural context.
Exactly. They're showing how they're used for food, for clothes, for weapons. And the neatest thing I saw on the islands, really, way back, the Hawaiians that lived in this section divided the land up in big rectangular or pie-shaped pieces that went from like 100 feet below the ocean to the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So every possible zone that you could have and plant and fish
diversity
and bird was
stuff,
in there.
Yeah.
And they stayed in these areas. Each each tribe, each chief got their own little section from the top to the bottom. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And of course, they fought back and forth and killed each other on a regular basis, as humans will do, but still, it was so neat. And part of what they're doing there is to show you how this was done.
Mm-hmm.
The different zones of life in Hawaii, which literally go from snow to tropical beaches.
It's amazing.
Yeah, Bernice was, and she's a native, very enthusiastic, and was great.
Okay, sounds good. We look forward to that. That's coming up on Homegrown. We also talk with Alan Patterson to get the rundown of the history of Kew Gardens. They celebrate their 250th anniversary this year. Of course, the gardens at Kew have royal linkages, right, Bob?
Exactly.
And as such, being around for 250 years, you can imagine that the gardens are pretty impressive. A great deal of research has been done there. Great plant hunters have been sent out around the world over the century as well to collect plants. So we'll find out some more detail from Alan Patterson coming up after we travel to Hawaii first, though, right?
What a show.
Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Actually, you know, as a result of the recent storms, I was walking around trying to figure out what used to be sun, or what used to be shade is now going to be sun.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, I got about 15 or 20 different places that I got to change and move things around.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm doing. In my mind, I'm walking around saying how much, you know, east sun, west sun, all sun, used to be shade.
Mm-hmm.
What do I got to move? What do I do now?
It's a
I think
good idea.
Most of us are doing this, actually.
I think, yeah. And if you're not, take a cue from Bob, that you should be sort of assessing what's turned into. Maybe we'll have to address that some in the spring as well.
Yeah, for sure.
What's turned into sun all of a
sudden. Right.
Anyway, yeah, I've noticed too, just kind of doing the same thing, being anxious for spring, actually, Bob, that it has indeed sprung a bit.
Yeah.
Bulbs are starting to come up.
Yep.
You know, the foliage is popping through. You know, no flowers yet. I have seen some of the little...
Snowdrops?
Snowdrops.
Yep.
Thank you. I'm like, what are they called?
Yeah.
Snow something.
Galanthus or something.
Galanthus, but and the Kyandoxa, those, you know, shorter ones, they're blooming. But other bulbs are just starting to come up. And now's the time, actually, if you've noticed that your bulbs have not performed very well, you can give them a shot of fertilizer right now as that growth starts to come up. The buds of trees are starting to swell. We even have some action on, blooming action on our cornice moss, the cornelian dogwood. One of the earliest flowering trees that I know of. Other things that are getting ready to pop, you can actually cut and force indoors if you want to put them in a vase, which is sort of cool. And the birds, your favorite bird, Bob, the red-winged blackbird.
Yep.
I've been seeing them for the past couple weeks, actually. The robins aren't flocking anymore. They're pairing off, which is a sign of spring and mating.
Must be love.
And just the different kind of songs that you hear, you know, it's a real specific sound. And one of the things I was thinking about to really take note of, because we're still waiting for this chipper thing to happen, and I've got all these mounds of brush mounds, basically, and I've got to make sure that we either get all that stuff thrown into the chipper before birds start to nest, or you got to wait, because the amount of birds that are going in and out of some of these piles that we have, it's clear that they're staking out some sort of nesting thing.
Uh-oh.
So don't kill birds in nests inadvertently if you're cleaning up debris. I mean, really, I'd hate to participate in that. So give that some consideration. Calendar, there's a couple of things going on around town. UDEL has an event, Fabulous Wildflowers, which of course is a fabulous spring thing to do, on March 7th, and out at Bernheim. They've got a Thursday morning sort of series, Bob, called Gardening Group, and it starts Thursday, March 5th, and then runs the 12th, the 19th, and the 26th as well. You can, of course, visit our website for more information on those two events. And then every year, the Bluegrass Beekeeping School takes place. So if you're interested in beekeeping, check this out, March 14th. It takes place at Kentucky State University in Frankfort. Registration, pre-registration, or you can register there, but it starts at 8 a.m. And it's got all the great, you know, speakers in terms of beekeeping. So definitely check that out if that's something that you're interested in.
And speaking of revering the past, the 18th annual Maple Syrup Festival will take place March 7th and 8th at Leanne and Michael Sugarbush Farm in Salem, Indiana. If you like maple syrup and wonder how it's made, this is a chance to find out hands-on.
Yeah.
Go to our website for details.
That's right, for all of it.
This is Bob Hill. Again, on my magical mystery tour of the Hawaiian Islands, and it's just been a great and gratifying place to be. Today's stop is at a marvelous place called the Amy B.H. Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden. It's on the Big Island of Hawaii. My guest today is a woman named Bernice Akamini. She is the ethnobotanical educator here at the Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden. And welcome to Homegrown.
Hi, welcome to Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden.
It's a marvelous place here, folks, for two reasons. One, they're restoring some of the native plants to Hawaii that the indigenous, as well as the endemic plants, some that were getting away from the country or the state, and some that were brought in here, and they're just preserving this way of life. But not only that, they're preserving the use of these plants for candles, for sandalwood, for food, for all sorts of reasons. These plants are being protected on a 15-acre site here that kind of flows down toward the Pacific Ocean. But first, we'll talk about Bernice a little bit, her history, and what got her to the Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden.
I went back to school as a resource manager. I got a grant to attend school in Washington State. And one of the things I realized was that I wanted to get back to Hawaii. So I came to the gardens in 2005 as an intern doing research on dye plants, Hawaiian dye plants. And I did an internship in 2005, 2006, 2007. And when there was a position open, they asked me to apply. And I obviously got hired.
Well, who was Amy B.H. Greenwell? Talk a little bit about what this place is and how it got here.
Amy Greenwell actually owned this site of land. She was a botanist and an amateur archaeologist. And she realized early on that the Hawaiian plants were dying out. So she decided that she was going to start preserving them. And with her love of plants, she naturally started planting them on her own property. Unfortunately, she dies at a young age. She dies at 53. So she left her 15 acres and to the Bishop Museum, specifically to preserve the Hawaiian plants.
Okay, and then we're going to jump over to Captain Cook because he plays a part in this part of the world too. Tell us about Captain Cook and when he got here and what that led to in terms of changing not only the culture but the plants and the animals of the Hawaiian Islands.
Well, Captain Cook actually arrives in Kealakekua Bay in 1779. So he is the first European that's credited with making contact with Hawaii. And what that does is that now opens the door for all these other merchants or sailors to come in and introduce species. So one of the things that happens is the sailors now start to come here as a stop to restock on provisions. And what they want to eat are not necessarily greens or fish, and they really want cattle or beef. And so they actually gift these animals. They gift the cattle, they gift goats and other animals to the chief so that when they come back, they will have the foods that they want to eat.
And that was the beginning of the end in terms of what was here initially, because of course these animals ran loose and started ripping into the flora and the fauna and kind of changed everything. Not only that, but the early Europeans changed the whole culture of the Hawaiian Islands. Talk some about that and what they banned their language, their religions.
Well, when the missionaries come in, you start seeing things like the religion, of course, was overthrown by the Hawaiian chiefess. And then you see hula is banned. You see the language is banned in the schools. The children aren't allowed to speak these languages. Well, not these languages, but Hawaiian specifically. So, and then everything changes. Now you have a new way of life. You have a monetary system as opposed to something that was more agricultural and barter related.
So basically what the Amy B. H. Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden is doing is bringing back some of the trees that have been lost, different zones, coastal zones, lowland dry forest zones, agricultural zones, upland forest zones. So let's start at the bottom with the coastal zones. What are you trying to recreate there that's been lost through the years?
I don't think it's so much that we're recreating things that have been lost. They haven't really been lost. But we are trying to preserve and educate the public that there is a definite connection between the Hawaiians and the uses of these plants. So in the coastal zone, of course, you will have plants that you would find, or you still do today, and you would have found previously in the areas near the beaches. So we are promoting how the plants were used by the Hawaiians. So what we do is we do have workshops, and every plant is labeled with its Hawaiian name, its scientific name, and how the Hawaiians use and sometimes still use the plants today. The other thing, so if we move up from the coastal zone to the lowland dry forest area, you'll see a lot of endangered species. And what we're trying to do here is not just preserve the ethnobotanical uses, you know, how the Hawaiians use the plants, but also we're trying to preserve species that are on the verge of extinction. And there are some plants there that were thought to have been extinct at some point in time, and then were found. And we have, like, the Kokio dry nariotes. There is just one plant left in the wild. If we look at the Kokio kukii, there are none in the wild. And they only exist in our garden because they are grafted onto the Kokio dry nariotes.
Okay, let's take some of the... We toured for about an hour, hour and a half, and walked around the 15 acres. Of course, you don't see these plants in Louisville very often, but the histories are very interesting. One is the state flower, the hibiscus, which is this beautiful yellow-flowered plant. Talk about that and its history and how you're preserving that.
Well, the ma'ohauhele is the state flower, and it's actually on the endangered species list. The Hawaiians obviously used it for dye-making, but one of the things we're doing is we are able to propagate and sell to the public. So this is one of the ways that the public can now help us by growing these plants in their own homes. They are not allowed to outplant, but they are allowed to plant at home. And then that expands the number of plants that you have, even though they're not now put in protected areas. So that's one of the things we do. The other things one of the things we do is also seed conservation. We do also go out into the wild and sometimes collect and then preserve those seeds or conserve those seeds. So we are trying to hit it on more than one level, not just growing and planting. We're also propagating and we preserve.
And it's not just flowers, of course, and trees. There's also, we saw a field or small plot of Polynesian gourds used for making music and storage and those kind of things. Talk about the history of those and how they got here and what's been done with them in Hawaii now.
The ipu that we have are the Polynesian gourds, and these are very thin-walled, and because they are thin-walled, they make perfect musical instruments because the sound really vibrates and resonates. So they are used to dance the hula. Those are actually the ones we looked at were ipu vai. So they were water gourds with long necks. So you would cut off the top, clean them out, and then you could store water and cork the top. So you'd have very little water loss from respiration. And also they had larger gourds that were used for putting food or for storing even their kapa or bark cloth in them.
And speaking of cloth, I know you do a lot of workshops here yourself where you dye fibers and cloth and really strands of pieces of the barks of the trees and the leaves of the trees. And one of them is the W-A-U-K-E, which I can't pronounce properly, but they call it the cloth plant. Talk about the cloth plant.
The vouke, or the paper mulberry, it's actually the same plant that the Japanese use to make paper, washi paper, and I think it's the same plant that's probably used all over the place. It is in the mulberry family, but the Hawaiians would use the inner bark. They would scrape off the outer bark, take the inner bark, ferment it in either fresh water or salt water for a week or two until it felt slimy and a little soft, and then they would beat it. They would then ferment it once again. They would wrap it up in tea leaf, and they would put it in bundles and have it ferment for another week or two until it felt really soft. And they would beat that into a really fine bark cloth that could be dyed either through immersion before it was completely beaten, or it could be dyed after. They could paint on designs, stamp designs on with bamboo stamps, ohekapala, or they could use the hala brushes, and they could paint on designs.
And then, of course, I've read about the breadfruit tree for years in history and about the exploration of the Pacific Islands and the South Pacific. And to come face-to-face with the breadfruit tree is kind of cool. It's got a big hanging down hunk of fruit. It looks like a round hunk of, well, loaf of bread, really. Talk about the breadfruit and what it meant to the culture here. And we'll move on to the taro, the really important one, next.
The breadfruit is a very important food plant. However, it is seasonal, so it is not as important as, say, the kalo is. But one tree would have a lot of fruit during its season. So for Hawaiians, they would eat it. They did make a sort of poi out of it. They would beat it. But they never fermented it like the Micronesians would do. The Micronesians would actually dig a hole in the ground and put the breadfruit in there, the ulu, to eat later. So that would ensure that you would have breadfruit throughout the beyond your season, beyond your fruiting season. So the Hawaiians actually didn't. The Hawaiian breadfruit tree is also sterile. It does not reproduce through seed. It actually sends out a root runner, and then another sprout comes up. So we actually now air layer those, but the Hawaiians would dig down, cut it apart from the mother plant, and then create an entire new plant.
And, of course, when I finally saw a plant here, I recognized more or less the calocasia. There's the alocasia and the calocasias, but the calocasia here, or the taro, we call it, is probably the most important food source in Hawaiian history and Hawaiian culture. And it's just all over the place here. Tell us about that.
Well, the kalo plant is, I feel, the most important plant to the Hawaiian culture. Papa, Earth Mother, and Wakea, Sky Father, came together. And they had a daughter, and their daughter's name was Ho'ohokukalani. Ho'ohokukalani and Wakea comes together. They come together, and she becomes pregnant. Unfortunately, when the child is born, it is not fully formed. It is born prematurely. So they bury the not fully formed fetus in the ground. And from that spot grows the first kalo, or taro, plant. Wakea and Ho'ohokukalani come together again, and they have another child. And this time, the child is born, and it is the first Hawaiian. So that makes the kalo our elder brother. And it also connects us directly to our gods. So, yes, it is very important.
Yeah, finally, Bernice, you are part of the Center for Plant Conservation. What you're doing here is going on all over the world now, thank God. You know, in Kentucky and Indiana and Hawaii, anywhere you go, there's groups of people trying to bring back what we had and tie it into the past and educate children and younger adults in the ways and things that need to be saved. And to that end here, you've got a lot of kids walking around with shovels today, little guys and girls doing a lot of work out here. So tell us about your connection to the Center for Plant Conservation.
Well, we are a part of the CPC, Center for Plant Conservation group. We do preserve a lot of the species here. We do freeze seeds for the future. That's one of the things we do. And, you know, you had mentioned our children, and that's not necessarily under the plant conservation program. However, that does ensure, by working with these children and having them come to the garden, that the next generation will be aware of what's going on with, you know, not just the plants here, but plants everywhere. And it instills this responsibility in them. We have children today that are 6 years old and all the way up to, I think, 18. And one of the things we're doing with the children is we're beginning to, or we will start doing outplantings. So we are trying to supply as many native plants as we can to as many people as we can. We do sell, and we also give away a lot of them.
Well, Bernice, thank you. It's just been fun to talk to you. And here we are 4,500 miles from home, and we all think in the same way and doing the same thing.
Oh, thank you very much. And I really hope that your audience enjoys this.
Bernice Accomini is ethnobotanical curator at the Amy B.H. Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden in the island of Hawaii. For more information on the garden or to see my photographs of the garden, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy. And we're moving along. And regretfully, I have never visited Kew, although this book has totally primed me for it. But you've been there.
Yeah, it's one of the great, it's a religious experience.
Yeah.
It just is. This is one of the great gardens in the world. And it's all we'd hoped and more. And I wish you had a week instead of a day. You just can't begin to see it all.
A place that you have to go back to.
I will.
And certainly our guest today will tempt us and guide us a little bit on that. Alan Patterson is joining us. He is the former director of the Royal Botanical Gardens in Ontario, an advisor to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and was the curator of the Chelsea Physic Garden back in the 1970s. He's the author of dozens of books on horticulture. His most recent accomplishment is the book The Gardens at Kew, published just in time to celebrate 250 years at Kew this year in 2009. Alan, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. My great pleasure.
Great. Thank you. Alan, for anyone who is not familiar with Kew, can you first describe the place and its significance to horticulture worldwide?
Well, that needs quite a lot of description, I think. It is an area of land, about 300 acres, what's that, 150 hectares, of riverside gardens and grounds and arboretum, about 7 miles southwest of the center of London. Mm-hmm. The River Thames flows on its western side, and it's been parkland gardens for several hundred years. The real significance is that the two or three big houses, mansions, within the grounds or on the edge of the grounds were in royal possession. Mm-hmm. And because of that continuation of royal possession, which then subsequently became involved with government funding and so on, means that it's got a sort of continuum that makes it historically and aesthetically and in many ways very, very significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alan, what was there before Kew? Was it particularly good ground for what it ended up being?
On the contrary, it's absolutely useless ground.
Okay.
It's very poor, gravelly river terrace. Mm-hmm. It's really just fortuitous that, of course, in the 16th, 17th century, even well into the 18th, travel by land was very, very difficult, uncomfortable, slow, you know, horses okay, coaches dreadfully slow. And so anybody, if they were sensible, traveled by water. And so you get from London, the capital, for several, what shall I say, 40, 50 miles, as long as the Thames is easily navigable, mm-hmm. you get great houses, the nobility, rich merchants, and particularly royalty, having their estates on the side of the river. Mm-hmm. And so, to some extent, the fact that Kew is on the River Thames, as I say, less than 10 miles from the center of London, yet in the country, as it then was, made it a perfect place for royalty, in particular, to have their initial, their closest country estate. Mm-hmm. And of course, anybody who was anybody, just as in the States, everybody has a cottage. Well, nearly everybody. These, to some extent, were the great cottages mm-hmm. for the magnates and royalty upriver, and of course upwind in
yes,
southern England.
Sure.
As you know, the main wind direction is southwest, with just coal fires. It was rather sensible that you had your country estate upwind.
Sure.
And that's exactly why so much of this happened, mm-hmm. and by good chance the Thames flows mm-hmm. in that sort of west-east direction.
So, Alan, how did it all start to evolve and emerge as, you know, the queue that we know today? And who was primarily responsible?
That is the thing that we're really celebrating this year, mm-hmm. 2009, because it's the 250th anniversary of a little area of Botanic Garden that Princess Augusta, she was the Princess of Wales, husband to Frederick, Prince of Wales. They were both keen gardeners. Indeed, it was said that he died through going out into bad weather and so on mm-hmm. To encourage the work going on in the gardens there. So in the mid-18th century, it was a highly fashionable thing to do. All the best people gardened. Mm-hmm. Not all of them did it personally. and the gardening, of course, was generally not what we consider mm-hmm. Gardening. It by growing lots and lots of small, pretty plants. This was landscaping on the grand scale with lawns, trees, vistas, garden buildings.
Yeah, architecture stuff.
Architecture. Yeah. Uh-huh. In fact, it was turning the countryside into garden. And then, of course, there was something of a reaction to that of turning gardens into countryside. Mm-hmm. But while that grand English landscape garden pattern was highly fashionable and started in Britain, spread to the continent, spread to the States, as you well know, Princess Augusta was interested in plants. And she started collecting quantities of plants and laid out a small area quite close to the then important house, the White House, rather in the fashion of the early physic gardens. And I've found that what she laid out was something very much like the Chelsea Physic Garden or the Oxford mm-hmm. Botanic Garden or the Botanic Garden at Leiden in Holland. Quite a small area, 3 or 4 acres, lots of long, narrow beds, and all the plants you could possibly grow outside. Mm-hmm. And, of course, backed by a huge greenhouse in which to grow plants that you couldn't grow outside in the British climate. Mm-hmm. So it was this obsession, really, with collecting. And that is what...
how it started.
Well, royalty, mm-hmm. rich people have always done. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they've collected plants, sometimes it's been animals, sometimes it's been jewels or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this cabinet of curiosities in many ways.
Right. Alan, you mentioned a physic garden, not a term we use here in the States much. Could you explain what that is?
Yes. As the name indicates, it's concerned with medicine, and it was the idea that you would grow in a garden all the plants that were known to be efficacious in curing human diseases, or indeed animal diseases as well.
Now, did Augusta have a particular school of gardening in mind, or a particular father figure for what she was doing when she planted her garden?
I don't think so. It was following on from the early physic gardens, which were synonymous with botanic gardens. Really, her concern was to grow as many plants as she could. They were grouped in significant ways, and of course, one has to realize that in the mid-18th century, too, Carl Linnaeus, the great Swedish botanist, was starting to put out his idea that you needed to classify plants in a sensible fashion, otherwise you couldn't really talk about them unless you can relate them to each other, and equally you couldn't do so unless they'd got convenient names.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, after Augusta, who takes the helm and starts to shape Q from then on, or what happens?
One talks about Princess Augusta, or one talks about a single king or a queen. Of course, they don't work in isolation any more than prime ministers or presidents. Mm-hmm. They have their advisors. Princess Augusta was fortunate that she continued to take the advice of Lord Bute, the Earl of Bute, who was who for a very short time, in fact, became prime minister. But he was a much better gardener than he was a prime minister. And he very fortunately became interested in the great circumnavigation of the world that Captain Cook had done.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Cook had taken with him Sir Joseph Banks, who was a rich young man, a keen botanist. He went round the world with Cook, ostensibly on that voyage to look at the transit of Venus, mm-hmm. which was going to be seen more better in the Pacific than anywhere else. But they had secret orders, at least Cook did, to search for the unknown southern land, which of course was Australia. And although the flora was and is absolutely fascinating from a botanical point of view, there's very little economic worth apart from trees there. There are no important food plants that were discovered, and nor have been, I think. And so it was very necessary that Kew could send out, or was instrumental in making sure that went out, were the vines and the cereals and all the other things that you needed to set up a real new civilization, mm-hmm. and, people living there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kew, because of those two people, the belief of those two people very strongly working together, that this was for the benefit of man, with mm-hmm. a capital M, that Kew became the sort of great entrepot into which significant plants came and significant plants were sent out.
I see.
And they then started to set up satellite gardens in already established colonies, in the West Indies particularly, in Ceylon, some of them, during their time, some of them after. Australia, of course, is famous now for its botanic gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also concerned to continually to import plants from all parts of the world, not least, of course, North America.
Right.
So what time frame was this, Alan? This is when Kew became Kew, it seems. What time frame are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the 1760s on.
Okay.
And from that point on, Kew was going to be the world's greatest garden somehow.
Well, the royals had it. They were convinced it was probably the greatest garden. Anyway. But it was as it developed as this, as I say, this sort of entrepot, and when also a professional staff of significance started to develop. So William Ayton and subsequently his son were the early curators. They collected quantitative plants, I say, wherever they could, and they were imported wherever they could. People were encouraged to send stuff to them. So one sees gradually although this was a royal preserve, and it is still owned by the crown, although it was initially, as it were, in the hands of the king, it gradually became of greater and greater economic and hence national importance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the architecture of the place, talk some about the buildings and the conservatory, and when did that become part of the landscape design?
If you're talking about the architecture, the first thing, I don't know if you've seen the book that I've just done.
Yeah, it's right in front of me, yes.
We both have a copy in front of us.
Well, it's in front of me too, so snap. The first picture you see on the cover is that wonderful and absolutely dotty pagoda.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
When I was a student at Kew all those years ago, we had a thought that we'd put an advertisement in the local Richmond paper saying 10-story maisonette to let. But in the end, we didn't dare. We'd probably been chucked out. I was a student gardener at the time. But the pagoda, of course, is one of the few remaining 18th-century buildings when the gardens at Kew were a landscape park in the fashionable sense that was happening throughout the country. The movement from landscape park, as I've already indicated, was particularly concerned with Princess Augusta, with her collections of plants in the small botanic garden area. And it was because then subsequently that they wanted to grow more and more plants from the tropics and the subtropics,
so they
and even the warm temperate areas, mm-hmm. that they had to start working on considerable glass houses. Mm-hmm. Now, the early ones, the 18th century ones, have generally not survived, except in illustrations. George III and Sir Joseph Banks both died, I think, in 1820. After that, the individual royals, George IV, you know, the one that had been Prinny, William IV, and then Queen Victoria, mm-hmm. were not themselves intimately involved in Kew. They'd got other palaces and other places. But because by the death of George III and Banks, the place was of, as I say, such economic importance because of its imperial role, mm-hmm. then in the early part of the 19th century, technology had come forward so well that the greenhouses that started to be built became themselves iconic. And so there's the enormous palm house, which was designed by Decimus Burton and a great ironmaster who worked with him. And that, of course, continues, as does the temperate house, which was the biggest glass house, I think, in existence at its time. We're talking now about the 1840s, 50s. Mm-hmm. And since then, other glass houses have been added to enable this, the world's flora to be built. Mm-hmm. You see, if you look in the book, you'll see pictures of the most lovely building, 18th century building, called the Orangery, mm-hmm. which was built as a greenhouse,
right.
but it was... It always has been incredibly bad at growing plants. not nearly enough glass. I mean, it's a very beautiful building, and it's now
a restaurant.
A restaurant, by far a better restaurant than it ever was a glass house. And even Sir George Taylor, a director who I knew well, sort of 30 years ago, I suppose. It had been turned into a wood museum for many years. He determined that it should be, it was a glass house, it should be an orangery again. And they tried, they got the orange trees back, they put in lighting inside and so on, but it never really worked. And so I think it's been taken perfectly sensibly, feed the people that come.
Alan, it continues to be dynamic too and like evolve in more contemporary times as well. I was fascinated by the treetop walkway. And that's relatively new in the larger scheme of things as
absolutely.
Well,
absolutely,
right?
Only this last year.
Okay.
Yes, it is. I think you're absolutely right, Janine. The fact that it is dynamic is one of the reasons why it's really kept its role.
Mm-hmm.
Because although one talks about the gardens and we see all these lovely pictures and I visit and another million of people every year visit, what we see is only the body beautiful, as it were. What is really significant to world botany is the science that's going on in the laboratories and in the herbarium and at Kew in the Country, Wakehurst Place, the Millennium Seed Bank. And these are the right. things that are absolutely really vital to the scientific world. Mm-hmm. It's concerned with global warming. It's concerned with conservation of plants. It's concerned with habitat restoration. And it's because the science has continued from Princess Augusta's day, primitive though it was at the time, the fact of collecting documented plants and maintaining records about them
mm-hmm.
is the sort of start of botanic garden science, and then it moves into molecular botany and so on, as it of course is today, and so DNA concerns and so on.
So today there's considerable preservation and conservation efforts taking place. You all, I mean, you had mentioned too that you were a student there.
Yes.
Does Kew continue to offer educational opportunities
at a
for
number
people?
Of levels? Yes. Mm-hmm. The thing I was involved in, of course, because I'm a gardener, was the student gardener course, and one did there was then a 2-year certificate course. You had to have had several years practical experience at other places. I'd been at the University Botanic Garden at Cambridge for several years before that. And then you were, you know, you had this wonderful 2 years, or in my case, I had a bit longer, working with this incredible collection of plants. You moved around from area to area, 6 months at a time, working in the palm house or the rock gardens or the temperate house or the propagation areas, and there were, I don't know, 20, 25 students, I suppose, doing that when I was there. It's become a much more, well, it's a much more modern course now. That mm-hmm. was 50 years ago. So it's now a 3-year diploma course. Students are expected to have had to virtually have had undergraduate experience before they come, and it is now equal to a full degree course. Mm-hmm. It lasts for 3 years, and the graduates of that course go out to, basically to run gardens around the world.
Right. Yeah, Alan, your book, The Gardens at Kew, is a wonderful primer for anyone wanting to visit there because you can't see it all, but you can see it in your book. How long did that take, and how did you put it together?
Well, I worked at I retired from being director of a botanic garden, Royal Botanic Gardens in Canada, a dozen years ago, and it's good to have when you're retired a sort of book on the hob to do something in the winter mornings.
Amen. Right. Amen.
And this one took, I suppose, 3 years of winter mornings.
Okay.
And then you can do a little bit outside in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. so it's a sort of 3-year thing, and the great joy was bringing this story together as well as possible for a general audience. It's there is a wonderful history of Kew by Ray Desmond, who is an old friend, and he was the librarian for years, and he's now really Kew's historian. But that is a very, you know, something of a specialist book, and it was invaluable to me when I was bringing the rather more popular story together.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, one more question, okay? Kew,
yep.
Is there any significance, meaning, reference? What does the word mean?
Oh, dear.
Do we know? It's just Kew.
I mean, it's just the name of the place.
It's just the name of the place. All right.
It's just the name of the place. You've got to call it something, haven't you? It's like plants.
Right.
Unless you've got a name you can't refer
That's
to.
That's right. So it just happened to be Kew.
It just happens to be Kew.
Sounds great. Thank you, sir, so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My great pleasure. Thank you for talking to me.
Uh-huh. Alan Patterson is the author of The Gardens at Kew, published by Francis Lincoln Press. The book takes a look at the people, the gardens, the plants, the architecture, and the research of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. From Sir Joseph Banks to Stephen Hopper, it's one of the world's finest botanic gardens, situated just outside of London, England, and 2009 marks the garden's 250th anniversary. Of course, for more information, you can see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill with a few questions to be answered.
We do indeed.
The first for Miss Wishy from right. Mr. Hill. From a Lou Hess with a question about wood ash, the pros and cons. We get this every time in the winter. About putting ashes on the lawn or garden?
I would first and foremost get a soil test. You have to get a soil test to see if you actually, you know, are going to do any harm or good. Wood ash has a liming effect, so it will make the pH go up a bit. So if you don't need a liming effect on your lawn, I would not put it on your lawn. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't put wood ash on your lawn anyway. What I would do is if you have a compost pile, you can work it into your compost pile. I'll dump some in the vegetable plots because it is pretty soluble, if you will. You know what I mean? It breaks down in the soil pretty quickly. But you want to make sure you know what your soil pH is so that you don't take it someplace where you don't want it to be by using your wood ash. The best place, really, the safest place, I think, otherwise would be working it into your compost pile.
Yeah, and it's not a panacea. Some people think they dump wood ash, that's all they need, and my plants are going to be fine.
But I mean, it
doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah.
But it's not that's
but
great
it could hurt
overall.
Stuff. If you put it around your blueberries or your azaleas or your rhododendrons or your boxwood, those are all acid-loving plants, and they're probably going to get chlorotic. So you do need to be mindful about knowing what your pH is and what your plants want. So compost pile is probably the best place for it, Bob.
Okay.
All right, here's a question. This one's from Rod. Greetings, Bob and Janine. I live in Crescent Hill. Our neighborhood once was noted for our large, mature, tree-lined streets and yards. Sadly, we've lost so many trees due to Hurricane Ike and the ice blizzard of 2009 that it may be another generation before we replace what we've lost. My question is, are some trees better adapted to handling ice than others? Likewise, are there some species that are especially susceptible? I happen to think that all this quote-unquote weird weather isn't weird anymore, that it is the new normal. So he'd like his trees to have a chance. So less susceptible or particularly susceptible? Number one and two particularly susceptible in my experience, lacebark elms and white pines.
Yeah, I lost both those. And let's keep in mind now, this is, I still think, a 1 in 50 year event, no matter what Rod may think about this, but who really knows? But walking around my yard, my ginkgos look really good. I had no trouble with ginkgo at all. My beech trees were fine. They hold the leaves in the winter sometimes, and still, in spite of having the leaves on, the beeches were fine. They're slow growing, but a great tree. And my sugar maples, I lost some limbs, but by and large, they're pretty tough trees. So that's three trees. But they're going to take a while to get established, too. These aren't trees you're going to plant and have shade in 5 years. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind.
Well, and like, too, if you look at some of those trees that Bob mentioned, Rod, like focusing on what trees have strong, typically strong main leaders.
Right.
And that's going to give you an indication that they may hold up better, not only in just ice, but also wind. So strong main leaders like bald cypress, they weren't touched at all.
Mine were fine, yeah.
Let's see, the black gum held up really well.
Yep.
Most of our oaks held up really well also. But also realize if a tree's got decay or is stressed or weak in some sort of way, it's going to be damaged no matter what it is, with an inch and a half of ice on it and all that weight. Another thing too, Bob, I noticed a lot of weepers were just fine. So I don't know if it's just because the gravitational pull is already going down that there's not that heavy load set that broke so many branches.
All mine survived. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then also almost all of our evergreens were perfectly fine, except the white pine. The small needles, the firs, the Serbian spruce, all of those, because they're shorter needles and they kind of dangle down, seem to withstand the ice.
My arborvitaes took a whipping.
Arborvitaes, cedars, white
pines
took a whipping.
They broke in half in some places, but the rest of them are coming back up, but they did take a whipping.
Right, yeah. So if you're that droopy sort of northern Christmas tree, pine tree looking thing, you can hold up pretty well. If you're more tight, compacted, long needles, it was a little trickier for you. So, and like Bob said, it was an exceptional ice storm. So, you know, it culled the weakest, I suspect.
For sure. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. And Miss Wishy, it's still early in the year, and we've got a Latin word of the week that seems to match that.
Exactly. The Latin word of the week is praecox, means very early.
I didn't know that.
And of course, very early can be relative, don't you think?
Yeah.
Mostly, it suggests very early in the season, but it may mean very early, sort of, relatively speaking, of that particular species,
like precocious or something.
So, for example, Agapanthus praecox. It doesn't have a common name, but Agapanthus is gas plant, right?
You say that in the air, I guess we can.
Gas station plant.
Right.
Agapanthus praecox. This particular Agapanthus is going to come on earlier than some of your other species. Allium praecox.
The early onion. Oh, yeah.
Dreaded
early onion.
Chimonanthus praecox.
Winter sweet.
The name says it all. It's still in the winter.
A poetic name to boot.
Helianthus praecox.
The Texas sunflower.
An early blooming sunflower.
Oh, yeah.
Lindera praecox.
Absolutely. Early spice bush.
Early
bloomer.
Spiranthes praecox.
The green vein lady stresses.
And that's a beautiful little terrestrial orchid.
I've not seen that. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just did see
orchid. Yeah, you probably
did. Why?
Well, no, actually, I think a lot of the spiranthes are from our parts, not necessarily the beautiful tropical parts.
You're probably true.
Thymus praecox.
The mother of all time.
Mother of all time. Mother of time. Thymus praecox, yeah. Mother of time. So yes, if you see praecox, P-R-A-E-C-O-X, you will know that something about that plant will likely come on very early.
I didn't know that. I learned something myself.
Good. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, more from Hawaii and an update on this year's All-America selections.
Homegrown is produced by the always timely Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.